trust is not what you think it is. Let me start with that. But you already know that that's my feelings about trust. And in this episode, I'm going to cover three areas where my work on trust is different than anything before it or any other work related to trust. The three areas that I will cover in this episode are areas where my definition of how trust behaves is unique. I will talk about the relativity of trust, the reciprocity of trust, and the two sides of trust, right after this. Welcome to The Trust Show. I'm Yoram Solomon, your host, the author of The Book of Trust, and facilitator of the Trust Habits Workshop. My mission is simple. I want to help you form habits that build your trustworthiness, because the answer to this question will have the biggest impact on your personal and professional success or failure. Can I trust you? My work on trust started back in 2017, 2018. I've been working on innovation and innovation culture all the way back from my PhD dissertation in 2008 and even before that. And it was 2017, 2018 that I realized that trust is important and trust is the foundation for everything. But that wasn't actually the reason that I decided that I'm going to focus on it 100%. Because, you see, if my perspective on trust, if my definition of trust would have been exactly the same as any other definition that existed before, then I would probably not do it. I mean, there's no point in just rewriting what everybody else, re-saying what everybody else has been saying before me. I was reading a lot. I was reading pretty much every book that was written on trust, and not all of them are good, by the way. I was reading every research article written about it. I read a lot of top publications and everything written about trust. And then I stopped and I asked myself, do I agree with that or do I have a different perspective? Now, I did not force a different perspective. I realized that I have a different perspective. And because my perspective on trust is different enough that I decided to focus on trust and have been doing that for the last pretty much 7 years, I would say 7 years plus, because trust was part of my PhD dissertation that started in 2008. A big part of it, of my definition of trust, falls under the eight laws of trust. And the eight laws of trust are really, those are not laws that I created, invented, suggested, or anything. They're really my observations over the years. I mean, initially I observed, I think, five of them, and then it became seven, then it became eight. And for the last 4 years, I would say, it's been those eight laws. And I stuck to them. So in today's episode, I'm really going to talk about three of them and kind of touch on a couple of the components of my relative trust model. But I'll talk about three of those laws of trust, specifically trust law number three, the trust is relative, trust law number six, the trust is reciprocal, and trust law number eight, the trust is a two-person game. I'll start with trust law number three, the trust is relative. It's actually the trust is personal because it's relative in more aspect than one. I kind of bundled them together, but trust is relative. The trust is personal. That was actually the topic of my second TED Talk. My second TED Talk was called The Relativity of Trust. And here's where it differs. Here's how I want you to think about trust differently than what you've heard before. And that is, there is no checklist. There is no checklist of components, characteristics, whatever you call them, that makes a person trustworthy if you can check every one of them. And obviously, every box has a very clear black and white, good or bad. So the most trusted people are the ones who will check all the boxes in the good side. Okay. It's not like that. You know, I typically give an example of some components are, some things are, like, for example, telling the truth. And my question to you is, would you ever trust somebody who knowingly and intentionally lies to you? Well, it sounds pretty black and white, but in reality, it's not. Because let me ask you a question. What if somebody lies to you knowingly and intentionally, but their intention is actually to protect you? Maybe they're not telling. Maybe it's not a lie. Maybe they're not just telling you the whole truth. But they're doing that to protect you. Is that a person you should not trust? I mean, their intentions are good. Their action, we may argue. And I can tell you that from talking to people, not everybody holds my opinion, which is I don't want anybody to lie to me. Don't protect me with lies, okay? Then there's this whole white lie. You know, does this dress make me look fat? How do you answer that? With truth or trying to protect the person that you're answering? And you know, I know there are different people that are going to answer this question differently. Which brings me back to the point of trust is relative. And I'm touching on one of those components that is the most black and white, lie or truth. And you can see that even that changes because intention does matter. But there are other components that are less black and white. I think it was last week that I did an episode on procrastination, whether it's good or bad. And, you know, if you're a procrastinator, then you're probably not going to think that it's bad unless you do think that it's bad and you're just, you know, accepting the fact that you're doing something that's bad. And frankly, I gave an example. I looked at Google, search for the word procrastination. Every article, every piece that came out talked about how procrastination is bad. I looked at Amazon. Every book that came up talked about it as bad, as a disease that needs a cure. But bottom line is I'm a procrastinator and I don't think that it's bad. I think that there are good things about it. And I'm not going to dig into that because that's a whole topic that I covered in previous episode. But the thing is that procrastinators will trust other procrastinators because, you know, they're like you. And I would even say they would typically trust other procrastinators because you'll find that even that is asymmetrical. Because I may accept the fact that I'm a procrastinator, but I'm not going to accept the fact that somebody else is a procrastinator, which is kind of an interesting dichotomy. How about risk taking? You know, is that good or bad? And you can't answer that absolutely or universally. Risk taking can be good, it can be bad, but risk takers, they accept it. Non-risk takers, people who are risk averse, have a problem with risk takers. They consider them irresponsible, reckless, not to be trusted because they're taking risks that I personally don't think that should be taken, at least not by them. How about perfectionism? You know, teaching entrepreneurship, one of the processes, principles that I teach is the whole principle of lean startup, the minimum viable product, you know, just get something out there to test it, even if it's not perfect, even if it's far from perfect. The whole concept of the minimum viable product or MVP is that you get something that's far from perfect, but it's enough to learn. And other people are more perfectionists and, you know, those are the people that typically use the phrase measure twice, cut once. And I remember an experiment that was done actually on a TED Talk, or the results were demonstrated on a TED Talk, on the marshmallow challenge where people were planning and planning and planning on how to build this structure that has a marshmallow at the top. And they were planning and almost using the entire time for planning. And then when they got to execution, they realized that the facts of life as they thought they are not what they are. And for example, that a marshmallow weighs way more than you thought it did. And that's when you realize that you shouldn't have tried to perfect your product, but actually start. But again, those are different things that neither one of them is good or bad. But the problem is that a person that holds one position, a perfectionist, would not trust a person that holds the other position. Somebody who wants to just get something out there and try it, even though it's far from perfect. A risk taker would not have a problem trusting someone who's risk averse. Or maybe they will have a problem because they're holding, they feel that the risk averse people are holding them back and they don't see the big picture. Whereas somebody who is risk averse will definitely not trust a risk taker. And they're the same for procrastinators and non-procrastinators. And I guess what I'm showing you here is that trust is relative. That you can't be trusted by all people, because the same behavior that would cause one person to trust you could cause another person to distrust you because they're different. And I already showed you that it's also asymmetrical. And one of the biggest places where this plays a role is in my relative trust model, the component of personality compatibility, which is one of the strongest components in that model. To be personally for somebody to trust you, they have to be personally compatible with you, or you have to be personally compatible with them, and vice versa. That compatibility, I say compatibility and not similarity, because we don't have to be the same. My wife and I are not the same, but we're compatible. We complement each other. We can be complementary, which makes us compatible. So there are things that must be exactly the same. For example, my wife and I we have allergic reaction against people who are late. Can you imagine? And my wife and I are kind of, we believe that ladies early is on time is late, late is unacceptable. We both believe that. We always show up early. We try not, sometimes we get to a place and we stay in the car because we're too early and we don't want to embarrass the other person or catch them unprepared, but we're not going to be late. Now, can you imagine if one of us was tends to be late to events and the other is the way we currently are, we would have a hard time trusting each other or being personally compatible, which is one of the foundations for trusting each other. So you can be different, you can be complementary, but it's important to be compatible. But that, even that compatibility, look, we're different people. The question is, how important are the incompatibilities? Okay, we're going to have some incompatibilities. My wife and I do have some incompatibilities, but such that we don't give, neither one of us gives higher importance or prioritizes them. So the being different doesn't mean that you're not going to be able to trust the other person. The question is, are you different in a way that's creating incompatibility? Because you can be different in a way that creates a complementary relationship. And if it is incompatible, is it prioritized high? Incompatibilities, or I should say high priority, high importance incompatibilities, causes you to lose trust. You would think that the component of competence is absolute or universal, but even that's not. How do you think about people who are less competent than you or more competent than you? Less confident than you, more confident than you, then these all fall under the area of the component of competence. So trust is relative, and it's relative because we're different people and we trust different people. What does it mean? What are the implications for that? There is one very important, so it's a difference than the way other people think about trust. Other people think about trust as a checklist of things that are good or bad. Everything is absolute and universal. If you can check all the checklist as on the positive side, so you're good, then you're going to be trusted. And that's not the case. I already showed you that it's not the case. But what does it mean? So, that difference, what does it mean for you? What are the implications for you? And there's one very, very, very important implication, and that is you have to treat your trustworthiness in every relationship independently. You can't have a general view of all the relationships and what you're doing for all the relationships, Because, as I said before, the same behavior that would cause one person to trust you could cause another person to distrust you. So you can't assume that that's a good behavior. It's a good behavior in one relationship, not in another. Bottom line is, think about the relationships that you want to be trusted in, not all relationships, and make sure that you're doing the right things that would make you trusted in that specific relationship. That is, first of all, if you have the right motivation and you have the right capacity, if you're willing and able to do that, to change, if it's important enough to you, if that relationship is important enough for you, if this causes an incompatibility that's an important incompatibility, then the question is, are you able and are you willing to change? But you have to look at every relationship independently. And that's the most important implication of the fact that trust is relative. The second area I'll talk about is trust law number 6, the trust is reciprocal. Now, to clear one thing, when I say trust is reciprocal, I don't mean that if I trust you, you will trust me. I think I already proved to you in the previous segment that trust is asymmetrical. And in fact, the trust that I have in you is the product of my trustfulness and your trustworthiness. The trust that you have in me is the product of your trustfulness and my trustworthiness. And I'll talk more about that in the next segment. And trust law number 8. But for now, when I say trust is reciprocal, I don't mean the relationship between your trust in me and my trust in you. What I'm talking about is the relationship between my trust in you and your trustworthiness. And it's very easy to understand that your trustworthiness affects the trust that I have in you. That's an easy one. What's not so easy to comprehend is that the trust I have in you affects your trustworthiness. And think about that for a second. The level of trust that I show you affects your trustworthiness. Let me explain. The example that I like to give in my keynotes is that when your kid falls down, and what's the first thing that they do when they fall down? They turn around, they look at you. That's the first thing. They don't cry. They don't get up. Your reaction is what causes them to decide whether they cry or they get up and keep going. And that's how trust works as well. You know, I want you to imagine this. If I trust you and I show you that I trust you and you see that I trust you and I behave in a way that trusts you, what would happen if you don't believe that you actually earn or deserve that trust? What will you do? I mean, if I'm trusting you with something that you know that it's completely unfounded, like I trust you to fly the plane. Well, you're not a pilot. You don't know how to fly. So it doesn't matter how much I trust you with that. You're not going to be trustworthy enough to fly the plane. You don't know how to. You're going to come back to me and say, hey, I can't fly a plane. I don't know how to fly a plane. Your trust is misplaced in me. But that rarely happens. The alternative is to say, hey, you trust me. I don't earn that trust, and that's fine. And it doesn't bother me. The bottom line is that it does bother you. And it bothers you because it's a terrible feeling to know that somebody trusts you with something that you don't trust yourself with, that you don't believe that you earned that trust. It's called cognitive dissonance. And what it causes you to do is actually to step up and earn the trust that was already given in you. You know, in one of my surveys, I asked people, where do you start? Do you start by trusting people and letting them fail you before you trust them less? Or do you start by not trusting them and letting them earn your trust? And what I found was that we're kind of, you know, 50-50 on that. So, you know, I would say half the people are on one side, half the people are on the other side, further or closer to the middle. But that's where we are. So what happens when I trust you with something that you don't feel that, or at the level of trust that you don't feel that you earn or you deserve? You're going to work to earn that trust. That's an amazing thing if you think about it, because what this means is that your trustworthiness is affected by me. Turn it around. My trustworthiness is affected by you, by how you show me, the level of trust that you extend to me. And it's not enough that you extend that trust to me. I need to know that you extended this trust. And I think the implications of these are pretty simple, because what they mean is that you can affect another person's trustworthiness. You know, you can look at them and say, you're the only person responsible for your trustworthiness, but now you know that you actually have an effect on it because you showed them that you trust them. By the way, it works the other way around too. You can cause them to be less trustworthy by showing them that you don't trust them, that you distrust them. Or maybe even if you do trust them, you just don't show that to them. They can't know, they can't tell. And I wrote an article a couple of years ago called How Leaders Kill Trustworthiness. And that's how leaders kill trustworthiness. In one of my surveys, I asked, what's the most important quality for you in another person? And, number one was trustworthiness. I asked about six types of relationships, but trustworthiness was number one. On average, 61.2% of people said trustworthiness is the most important quality in another person. But it was really the most important quality in five out of the six relationships. In one of those relationships, trustworthiness was not the top one. When I asked leaders about their employees, number one was the willingness to work hard. 47.5% willingness to work hard. Only number two with 39%, still pretty high, but not number one, was their employees' trustworthiness. Now, what does it mean? What does it mean when a leader cares less than average, significantly less than average, 47.5% compared to an average of 61.2%, which, by the way, is affected by that 47.5%. So what does it mean? It means that leaders don't consider their employee trustworthiness to be an important thing. And if they don't consider it to be an important thing, they probably don't have any intention of trusting them. What does the employee feel? Well, the employee feels that their leader doesn't trust them, and therefore, they don't work hard to earn a trust that their leader doesn't have in them. You know, it's always harder to be the person that's ahead. You know, the person that trusts ahead of trustworthiness, the person who's trustworthy ahead of trust. It's hard to be the first to drive the trend. So you just make it harder. So trust law number six, trust is reciprocal. What does it mean? It means that you can affect another person's trustworthiness and therefore the level of trust, for better or for worse. And the third element or component, well, not really component, the third law of trust that I'm going to consider as being unique compared to anything else you heard about trust or learned about trust is trust law number six, trust law number eight. I'm sorry. Trust is a two-person game. And it comes down, and I mentioned in the previous segment, it comes down to the trust I have in you is the product of your trustworthiness and my trustfulness. My willingness to trust. So, you know, if you think that you're going to be trusted simply by how trustworthy you are, you already know, by the way, that some people are not going to consider you trustworthy, because the same behavior that would cause one person to trust you could cause another person to distrust you. And I gave you examples. But it's not enough for you to be trustworthy. The other person has to be willing to trust. You know, back in 1972, there was a survey done. I quoted that survey in the Book of Trust. And that survey was right before the 1972 elections. And it was trying to figure out who are the trustworthy politicians. And so it was a poll that was put out in the field. And the last moment, they added a few other personalities specifically TV personalities. Number one was Walter Cronkite. Walter Cronkite came in as more trustworthy than anybody else, including all politicians running for president, running for governors, or anything else. Walter Cronkite, number one. And CBS used that that line a lot since then. Walter Cronkite, the most trusted man in America. It wasn't 100%. It was 72%. 72% of people said that Walter Cronkite is the most trusted person. Not 100%. And that takes us back into it's not enough for you to be trustworthy by some people. You're not going to be trustworthy by all people, but it's not enough for you to be trustworthy. Look, we're the sum of our experiences. And we went through experiences that would cause us to not trust people or not trust people of a certain kind. You know, you may go into a restaurant and after that get a terrible stomach bug that or food poisoning or something that you got in that restaurant. And you're never going to set foot in that restaurant chain again. Well, you are the sum of your experiences. This is your experience and you're not willing to go into it. So you created a distrust against a chain of restaurants or an airline or I don't know what. So sometimes you categorize it. Maybe it's a large category. I don't trust people, period. All people, all kinds of people. I don't trust men. I trust women. I don't trust men. That's a categorization. That's a generalization. But that's important. That's important for you to know that the trust that I have in you is not solely up to you. And vice versa. The trust that you have in me is not purely based on my trustworthiness. I may be trustworthy in the eyes of other people, just not in your eyes. And the reason is not that you don't think that I'm trustworthy. It's just that you don't think that anybody is trustworthy. You have low trustfulness. What does it mean? What are the implications? Okay, great. So once again, I'm looking at trust differently, but what does it mean? Well, it means that if somebody doesn't trust you, it's not always your fault. And you don't necessarily have to fix yourself. That's one side of it. But the other side of it is that you have to keep in mind that my trustfulness, to a small degree, is dependent on your trustworthiness to a smaller degree because you represent, maybe you represent all people, maybe you represent a certain group of people, a certain type of people, that because of your behavior, I may trust or may distrust them more or less. You know, I remember back in the early 90s, I remember flying to Hungary that just came out of the Soviet bloc. And they were still very, very closed, I would say. They were curious, but very shy, I could say. And I remember going there knowing that for many of them, I'm probably the first Israeli they ever meet. And maybe the first one or that they're going to know for a long time. And what I realized is that whatever I do there will affect what they think about Israelis because I'm the only Israeli they've ever seen. So it was important for me to behave in a certain way that would leave an impression on their trustfulness or general attitude towards Israelis so that the next time they hear about an Israeli or think about an Israeli, they will have me in mind. The more of me, the more Israelis or anything else that I represent, the more they see, obviously, the more they're going to form their own trustfulness based on a larger sample. But right now, I was a sample of one. So again, what does it mean? What are the implications? First, I told you, it's not you, it's me, or it's not me, it's you. So think about the fact that in order for you to trust other people, you have to build your own trustfulness. You may not be trusting people simply because you're not a trustful person. You have to challenge your assumptions. You have to challenge maybe your biases into why you're not trusting other people. But also the third thing to keep in mind is that you may be, for someone, a sample of one. You represent a larger group, and there it comes with a larger responsibility. You know, I used to say that the trust that one person has in another depends on, or the trust that I have in you depends on, or is the product of your trustworthiness and my trustfulness. You can do, and you can do nothing about the latter, my trustfulness, and everything about the former, your trustworthiness. Well, that's not exactly true. And I changed that since then to, you can do almost nothing about my trustfulness, but you can do something because you're still a sample of a larger group that I have an attitude of trusting or not trusting in general. You can affect my trustfulness, not only your trustworthiness. Let me summarize. First of all, there are other rules of trust. As I said, I observed 8 laws of trust. I observed them, didn't create them, didn't make them up, didn't invent them. I observed them. And there are 5 others, which I didn't focus on here. But the important thing that I want you to get is that trust is not what you think it is. Trust is not what you would read about in other books. It's different. It's different, and my work is unique in identifying those differences and looking at trust in maybe somewhat uncomfortable way. It's a lot more comfortable to say trust or trustworthiness is a checklist of good or bad, and it's all absolute and universal. That's easy. But life is nuanced, and that's reality. So this is what made my work unique. And again, if I did not have a unique perspective on trust, I would not be pursuing this topic. I did create a relative trust model based on this uniqueness on those laws. There is one more thing that I do that's unique that I didn't talk about here, but I did talk about in previous episodes and previous seasons. And that is, you know, if I pointed out to you whatever framework I'm going to use, but I point out to you correctly, what do you need to change to be more trusted, even if it's in one relationship, to be more trustworthy? If I pointed to you and gave you that knowledge, would that be enough? The answer is no. To be practical, you have to form new habits that change old behaviors. And those will build your trustworthiness and therefore the trust in you. And I created a 7-step process that I trademarked, Trust Habits, that would be an actionable plan. Knowledge is not enough. Let me show you how. Not the what, the how. So that's kind of how my work is unique in the area of trust. And it resides in the intersection of the science of trust and the science of habit forming. But today I talked about what makes it unique in the area of trust, because trust is not what you think it is. This is it for today. I hope this made you think a little differently about trust. And today is yesterday was May 4th. So it would only be appropriate if I said may the 4th be with you, but I'm going to say may trust be with you. This was The Trust Show. What would you like to know about trust and trustworthiness? Let me know and I'll answer it in a future episode. I would love to hear from you. Email me at yoram@thetrustshow.com. If you like this episode, subscribe to the show so you will automatically get notified when I release a new episode. Rate it. Write a review for this podcast, because those ratings help not only you, but also others looking for podcasts just like this. If you're looking for more resources to learn about how to build trust, be trusted, or know who to trust, look up my workshops, online courses, books, or go to my website, trusthabits.com. And remember that the answer to these 2 questions will have the biggest impact on your personal and professional success or failure. Can I trust you, and can you trust me? Thank you for listening or watching The Trust Show.